Okay, good evening, everybody. Nice to see those of you who are with us on Zoom tonight. And this is the second in the series of contemporary halakhic issues and the Jewish life cycle. And we're dealing tonight with the questions of bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah in terms of modern problems that come up and modern applications that we should be thinking about. Now, the concept of becoming a bar mitzvah age 13 or a bat mitzvah age 12 is obviously not a modern phenomena in itself. The Mishnah in Masechet Avot tells us ben shlosh esrei mit le mitzvot, when a person's 13, they're chayv in mitzvot, and it's clear from sugyot throughout Shas that the age of chiyuv for a girl is when she's 12. How do we know this, that a boy becomes bar mitzvah when he's 13 and a girl when she's 12? The Rosh in the Tshuva tells us this is halacha l'Moshe Mitzrayim. We have a tradition about this. I don't know exactly when the concept of celebrating a bar mitzvah came about. In some sense, it goes back a couple of hundred years. Magen Avraham mentions the notion of, in the name of the Yam Shel Shlomo, of making a seuda on the day that a person becomes a bar mitzvah. We have the halacha in the Shulchan Aruch about saying the bracha Baruch Shep Tarani Me'on Shor Shel Azeh when a person becomes bar mitzvah. So those were things that certainly the bracha goes back many centuries. It's post-Talmudic, which is why, according to the Shulchan Aruch, we say it without Shem U'Malchut. The Vilna Gaon was of the opinion that you do say it with Shem U'Malchut. And the Suda goes back several hundred years. Having a party at the Kinloss Suite, or in my day, the Royal Majestic in Willesden, is something which is not mentioned in Shulchan Aruch and is a bit more recent. When they started that a bar mitzvah boy would lane, I've no idea. The notion that they'd be called up from the Torah also goes back some long time. But the notion of a celebration in the way that we know it is probably a much more recent phenomenon. But there are a number of questions that come up, and I want to flag up some of the questions and answers and look at them in a contemporary context. And then also we'll talk somewhat about bat mitzvah, which as a celebration is obviously a much more recent phenomena. Almost certainly our grandmothers wouldn't have known of such a thing. For many of us, our mothers wouldn't have known of such a thing either. But today, it's, I think the word is ubiquitous in modern Orthodox communities and beyond. So let's look at a couple of, we'll start with regard to bar mitzvah. I want to look at a couple of she'ilot and tshuvot of Rav Moshe Feinstein in Igrot Moshe. The first one, you might have it in front of you. It's been shared in the chat. I don't know. Jonathan, are you able to share that for us? I don't think I can do. He has that. Wonderful. Okay, thanks. So the first one is a question. Imlikro l'Torah v'yomah bar mitzvah shelo, v'ven Yisraelit ninochri. Are you allowed to call up and celebrate a bar mitzvah for the son of a mixed marriage, where obviously the mother's Jewish and the father isn't Jewish? If the father was Jewish and the mother wasn't Jewish, then it wouldn't be a question at all. The child's not Jewish and there would be no bar mitzvah celebration. I don't know how common this was in Rav Moshe Feinstein's experience in the Lower East Side in the 1950s, which is when this teshuva is dated. Of course, nowadays in mainstream communities, I would say throughout the world, certainly throughout the diaspora, this is a realistic phenomena, that you have intermarried couples Sometimes they're a member of a shul, sometimes they're not members of a shul, sometimes the grandparents are members of the shul. They want their grandchild to have a bar mitzvah, an Orthodox bar mitzvah. I'm sure this was a very common occurrence outside of the Jewish centres of New York and the like, even in the 1950s. What's the halacha? So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a very, very interesting response to this question. This is in Orach Chaim, Chelek Bet Siman Aleph Gimel. I'll leave it for people to read it through themselves if they want to study it themselves. I'll just summarize what he says. But he says that even though the child is definitely Jewish, nevertheless, if the mother is still living with the non-Jewish father, so then lemigdar milta, which really means as a preventative measure, and I would say as a matter of public policy, a bar mitzvah shouldn't be celebrated, because the subtext of doing this is that, yeah, it's all right to marry out, your children are still able to have a bar mitzvah, you can be still part of the community. Okay, fine, you married out, that's not really a big deal, it doesn't disqualify you from being part of the Orthodox community. He says that's not true, that marrying out is a terrible thing, and there's no reason why we should have celebrate a bar mitzvah for them. We need to set out our stall, and we need to communicate a message that intermarriage is not Jewishly acceptable. And he says, in actual fact, in the final line, what about even allowing such children into Jewish day schools? He says, if it's going to set a bad precedent and a bad example, asur gam medina, then he thinks it's absolutely against the din to accept such children into the education system. So this tshuva is very, very interesting. I wonder, was this policy of Rav Moshe Feinstein ever followed amongst American Jewry at any stage in the course of the past 50 years or not? Certainly, nowadays in, as I say, mainstream Orthodox communities which allow non-Orthodox people to be part of their membership, it goes without saying that we would have a bar mitzvah for a child from a mixed marriage. And I think we would regard it as being something positive. Say, listen, at least this is, we've got an opportunity to give this bar mitzvah boy an Orthodox Jewish experience. Who knows what's going to be in the future? He is Jewish. He's entitled, himself to an Aliyah LaTorah. We want to encourage him as much as possible to engage with his Jewish traditions and his Jewish heritage. Shuls which have exclusively Shomrei Shabbat members, then I imagine they wouldn't welcome a child from a mixed marriage to their shul for a bar mitzvah celebration. They also wouldn't welcome a child from a non-Shomrei Shabbat home to their shuls for a bar mitzvah celebration. These are interesting questions, perhaps more about the dynamics of the Orthodox community as a whole and notions of responsibility. Is Lemigdar Milta ever of any relevance, nowadays? If we, establish in the United Synagogue that there's going to be a policy of not allowing bar mitzvah for children from mixed marriages, even if they're halachically Jewish, or only if they're halachically Jewish, what would happen as a result? Would it stop anybody ever from intermarrying? The answer is definitely not. What would happen as a result? Some of those families wouldn't have bar or bat mitzvah at all, and they wouldn't engage with their children whatsoever Jewishly. And others would go over to the Reform or liberal non-Orthodox movements, where they would be made to feel welcome. And in actual fact, if I can sort of sidetrack and digress a little bit, it's an interesting, phenomena in contemporary Orthodoxy. Nowadays, certainly, I would say, in London, I would think that the number of intermarried families in the United Synagogue is extremely low, very, very few. Why do I say that? Because an intermarried family, if they come to a United Synagogue, the non-Jewish partner is not going to be welcome at events, not going to be able to participate neither in religious ceremonies, not in social events, and they're not going to feel welcome in this environment. Whereas they can go to a non-Orthodox environment, which will be much less judgmental about their situation and much more welcoming of the non-Jewish partner. So, you know, it's very rare that families like this are members of Orthodox shuls nowadays. I remember when I was a kid, you know, there were a certain number of families, you know, that we knew were intermarried families. Father wasn't Jewish, but they were still members of our shul. They showed up occasionally, children's service, bar mitzvahs. You know, every now and then there was a bar mitzvah where the father wasn't Jewish. In all my time, you know, over 25 years as a rabbi, as a communal rabbi, I can think of only one case when there was a non-Jewish father. I'm sure that was for a bat mitzvah, I think it was for a bar mitzvah, actually. It was for bar mitzvah. One case where there was a non-Jewish father in shul. Because I think by and large, those families go to the non-Orthodox. So, first of all, you know, I don't think that nowadays this Limigdar Milta that Rav Moshe Feinstein is talking about is relevant or effective. And in actual fact, perhaps it has, if anything, the opposite effect, that these families just won't engage in Judaism or in Orthodoxy at all. So, you know, it's worth thinking about in that regard. I also sometimes wonder, you know, there are plenty of shuls in Northwest London that wouldn't allow an intermarried family to celebrate bar mitzvah in our shul. We would. I don't think, by and large, these are the types of families that tend to join our shul. But it could be, let's say we had a non-affiliated family that came to us and said, we walk past your shul every weekend and we see there's a shul there. It's our son's bar mitzvah coming up. My husband's not Jewish. I'm Jewish. Our son's Jewish. We'd like to have bar mitzvah in your shul. Would we allow them to? I think we would. Our chairman's on the line here, so I don't know if he's got an administrative policy on this matter, but I think if I was consulted, which I hope I would be, I think I would say that we would. If the whole, you know, and that allows, of course, the more right-wing shuls to say that they won't. I wonder that, you know, if all the shuls weren't doing this, would the more right-wing shuls feel any sort of, you know, responsibility, you know, towards families like this? You know, currently they can say, listen, you know, it's not our problem. They can go to Aleh Tzion, they can go to the United Synagogue, they can have a bar mitzvah there. If we didn't exist and they were the only option, you know, would they jump on this Limigdar Milta notion and say we're not allowing it? Or would there be a different approach? And of course, it's not necessarily a bad thing that there are, you know, that we're doing one thing and they're doing different things, and we're all protecting Klal Yisrael in different ways with the same goal. But I think it's interesting that Kach Horez Akein, this is how Rav Moshe Feinstein paskened, but I don't think that certainly currently that would be regarded as a psak that we would follow. Let's move on to a second teshuva that he has, which, again, in the year 2021, is not really a point of discussion, certainly not in our communities. Again, maybe in some communities it is, but by and large, you know, it isn't. I think 30, 40, 50 years ago, it was a point of discussion. And here his question is, what about a bar mitzvah boy who's been educated to read Hebrew in the Israeli Havaras Sfaradit? He goes to a shul where everything takes place in the in Ashkenazis. is it permissible for him to lain in Havara Sfaradit or not? So again, going back, or let's look at it in a contemporary context. Contemporary context, most shuls that you'll go to in Northwest London, I think there's a range of pronunciations. Some will be almost exclusively Ashkenaz pronunciation, with a range, of course, of different pronunciations there: Hasidish, Litvish, Polish, Galatianas, etc., etc. But many shuls, there'll be a range. Some people using Havar Ashkenazit, some people using Havar Ashkenazis, some people using Havar Asfaradit, some people even using a hodgepodge of both. So if that's the case, if there's no fixed Havara in a shul, then obviously the Bar Mitzvah boy can lane in whatever Havara he has. What if it's a shul where everybody lanes in the one Havara? So that's an interesting, all the davening is in the one Havara. So that's an interesting question that Rav Moshe discusses. And he says that, certainly there are two issues here. There's one is the issue, is it a valid Havara? And the second question is, even if it's a valid Havara, is it legitimate to use it in an Ashkenazi shul? So he says, as far as the Havara is concerned, there are lots of different ways of pronouncing Hebrew, all of which are regarded as being valid. He says, never do we find that, for example, a woman who does chalitza, so that she's now allowed to get married, she has to say certain psukim in the original Hebrew. There's nobody says that she has to say it in five different pronunciations. It's Ashkenazis and Hasidish and Sfardish and Yekish and Taimani, etc. They're all kosher and valid. So it's definitely a kosher laning. He says the second issue is whether or not it's acceptable, in an Ashkenazi shul to change the minhag. And he says it's not. So he's going to have to learn to to lane in Ashkenazis because this is an Ashkenazi shul. That's in one teshuva that he has. He has another teshuva elsewhere on the same subject, where he actually says a bit differently. I think it was written about 5 years later, if I remember correctly. In another tshuva, he says that, in actual fact, in terms of the laning, it's not such a massive issue. So he says, certainly in terms of the haftarah, it's not a big issue if he does the haftarah in Havara Sfaradit. In terms of being shliach tzibur, he says, even being shliach tzibur, it's only occasionally. So it's all right. You can deviate from the minhag occasionally. What does he say about the laning? He said, sometimes it's going to be difficult for a bar mitzvah boy to learn to lane in a different havara to what he's used to. So he says what they should do in the shul is that it's important. This is an Ashkenazi shul where they always lane in havara Ashkenazit. They shouldn't lose that. So the Shabbat of the bar mitzvah, they should make up another minyan in the Beis HaMedrash where they will lane in Havar Ashkenazit. It doesn't need to be the main minyan of the shul. So long as the shul is still having a laning in Havar Ashkenazit, that's good enough. He says if they have Ashkama minyan regularly, fine, in Hashkama they're laning in Havar Ashkenazit. So in the main minyan, that's a one-off, they can lane in Havar Asfaradit because of Bar Mitzvah boy. It's not so terrible. So it's interesting there that he says, you've got to retain the minhag of the shul, but so long as one of the minyanim is doing that, then the integrity of the minhag of the shul is being retained. Now, as I say, I don't think, certainly in our shul, where there's no fixed minhag of Havara, so a person can come and lane in whatever Havara he has. And this is the case in many shuls. You'll get whatever the Baal Tefillah does. There's no fixed minhag as far as that's concerned. More interesting question would be, in an Ashkenazi shul, what if we had a boy from a Sfardi family and wanted to lane, Havar Asfaradit would be fine, but he wants to lane with the Italki tune or with the Spanish and Portuguese tune, or with the Moroccan tune, whatever it is. You know, we want to use a different trop to what we're used to. The trop used for the laning, of course, is more significant than the tune you use for singing Mincomcha in Shachrit Kedusha. Now, the fact that we might usually use a Shweki tune, and he wants to use a Pirchei Miami tune instead, that's totally unimportant. The trop used for the laning is much more an issue of Masora. And, you know, here you've got, you know, competing considerations. Now, certainly, judging by what Rav Moshe Feinstein is saying, you know, this is an Ashkenazi shul which uses Ashkenazi trop. We should be retaining that, even if we've got a range of Havarot. On the other hand, we might say that, listen, you know, we want to encourage people from different Eidot to retain their own minhagim, to have a pride in their own traditions. And yes, he's from a Moroccan family. Let him lain in the Moroccan Havara. Part of me says that there might be a difference between a London Kehillah and if we were in Leicester or Liverpool or Leeds or somewhere like that. In London, I can turn around to a Moroccan family and say, listen, you know, there's a Moroccan shul in Hendon. Go and have your bar mitzvah there. If I was the rabbi of Leeds or the rabbi of Leicester, that wouldn't be so possible. I suspect my lay leadership wouldn't be so enthusiastic if I was chasing members away to go and have their bar mitzvahs elsewhere and saying to them, oh, you know, we don't want Sfardim here. It's not that we don't want Sfardim here. In part, it is that Sfardim, you know, you should be proud of your own traditions. You know, retain them. Don't Ashkenazify yourselves. Your tradition is at least as valid as ours. Often these things get misunderstood and misinterpreted as religious racism, but I don't think it is that. I think that it's, you know, a pity that so many Sfardim lose their very rich halachic Masorah by being Ashkenazified in our schools and our shuls. Sometimes it's inevitable, sometimes it isn't. I suspect that in practice we would allow it as a one-off. You know, many shuls have a certain fluidity, but I think it certainly would be an interesting halachic shaila, and I might be tempted to try and retain what Rav Moshe Feinstein says. Maybe, you know, we say, well, seeing as we've got Hashkama, so in Hashkama they'll lain in regular Ashkenazi trop, and in the Bar Mitzvah Minyan they'll lain in the Moroccan trop. But it's certainly a shaila that would need to be addressed. So those are a couple of tshuvot from Rav Moshe Feinstein about Bar Mitzvah. I want to skip to the back page, and we'll come there, then we'll come back to the second, to Rav Moshe Feinstein, the second page again. A third question with regard to Bar Mitzvah that I want to flag up is discussed by Rav Nachum Rabinovich in Sheilot Tshuvot Siach Nachum, Simon Yud Chet. And also he refers us there to a tshuva of the late Dayan Rappaport, Zichron Olivracha, of the London Bet Din, also on the same subject, which discusses Bar Mitzvah boy who's blind and can read from Braille. So he obviously can't be, he can't lain from the Torah. That is taken as a given. You have to read Mitoch HaKetav. It's also taken as a given that at least for Ashkenazim, he can be called up to the Torah. Ashkenazim, the Mechaber, says that a blind person shouldn't be called up to the Torah because he's not able to read what he's being called up for. The Rama brings down, I think it's in the name of the Maharil, that we allow it. We allow to call up a blind person to the Torah because of Kvod HaBriot, human dignity. It's not nice. This person comes to shul all the time and has to sit there not being able to get an aliyah. It's not courteous. It's embarrassing for them. It's awkward for them. They'll feel upset that they're disqualified from an aliyah. So kvod habriyot, we allow them to be called up to the Torah. The question is about reading the Haftarah. Can they read the Haftarah from a chumash which is written in Braille? So Rav Rabinovich discusses it from the perspective of a sugya in Masechet Gittin, which talks about the circumstances under which Tanakh is allowed to be written down, and how ideally Tanakh should only be written down in complete scrolls. So you don't write just, you know, the Haftarah for Parshat Lech Lecha, Parshat Vayera, but you write the whole of, you know, for Lech Lecha, you'd have a scroll which has the whole of Sefer Yeshaya in it. For Vayera, you'd have a scroll which has the whole of Sefer Melachim in it. Just like, you know, on Parshat Vayera, we don't just take out a scroll containing Parshat Vayera and Lane from the Torah from that. We have to read it from a whole Sefer Torah. So really, you should read the Haftarah from a complete Navi. However, we don't, and not doing so goes back to Talmudic times when in some places they used to read from a Sefer Haftarta. That was a scroll which just had the Haftarot written in it. And then there's the question of why was that legitimate? And what status did that have? And he demonstrates how there are various different ways of learning the sugya. He says, in practice, what we seem to follow is the view that because of a notion of Eit La'asot La'ashem Heferu Torah Techa, because there's a notion that it's just impossible for every community to have its own set of Navi and to be able to lay in the Haftarah from a proper scroll. So then they said, okay, you know, even though generally speaking, you're not allowed to read Tanakh Baal Peh, read it off by heart. Nevertheless, as far as this is concerned, there's no alternative. So therefore, you're allowed to do it. And he says, in actual fact, the fact that we lay in the Haftarah every Shabbat from a Chumash, that means that we're not doing it in the proper way. The proper way, it's as if we're reading it Baal Peh. It's as if we're reading it off by heart when we read the Haftarah from a Chumash. And therefore, seeing as we're always reading it off by heart, so a Bar Mitzvah boy can read it from a Braille Chumash, and it's no different. That's essentially how Rav Nachum Rabinovich discusses it. Diane Rappaport has a slightly different approach. He says that essentially the din is that in terms of reading the Haftarah, a blind person has got no way of reading it from the Ketav. So therefore, he's allowed to read it Baal Peh. It's true that the Tzibur, everybody else isn't allowed to read it Baal Peh, but seeing as it's a legitimate way of him reading it, so therefore when he reads it on behalf of the Tzibur, or when he reads it B'Tzibur, then that's also legitimate. Seeing as it's legitimate for the blind person to read it that way, then it's legitimate for it to be read by him that way as well. It discusses the question whether or not the Tzibur really need to be Yotze with the reading of the blind person. So that's those are the main issues that I wanted to flag up with regard to Bar Mitzvah. Most of the questions that come up won't be anything radically new. You know, it's again, as I've pointed out so many times in these shiurim, that here we're looking perhaps at societal change rather than, you know, anything that, you know, makes it particularly modern in an intrinsic way. You know, it's because of the way society has changed or things going on in society then becomes a contemporary halachic question. Let's go on now to the question of Bat Mitzvah. So Bat Mitzvah as an orthodox phenomena, it existed in non-orthodox circles already 100 years ago in various ways, though the reform, in actual fact, initially were much more interested in having confirmation services when children were 16, for boys and for girls, than in having Bat Mitzvah. But it certainly existed in non-Orthodox circles in America already 100 years ago. But it didn't wasn't encountered really by Orthodoxy until either in America until the late 1960s, perhaps the early 1970s, perhaps the late 1960s. And there it was done in some progressive Orthodox communities. I say progressive with a small p, meaning communities, but which were trying to advance women's involvement. I wouldn't say necessarily women's rights, and I'm not using that as a loaded term. But in terms of wanted to make sure that young Jewish women, when they reach the age of mitzvot, feel included rather than sidelined. They feel valued rather than ignored. So Rav Moshe Feinstein has two teshuvot on the subject, written about 5 years apart, which are, I think, very, very relevant. The first one written in the mid-50s, the second one written in the late 50s. So if we look in the first one, we'll actually go through this one, I think, inside, seeing exactly what he says. So this notion that some people have got to have some sort of simcha for a bat mitzvah. Hine ein la'asot zeh bebeit ha'kneset b'shum ofen af lo balayla. This certainly should not be done in shul under any circumstances, even if it's at night when there's no service taking place. Ki bebeit ha'kneset einu makom la'asot divrei ha'rashut af benivnu al tanai. The shul proper, you don't do things which are not statutory, even if the shul was built so that you can do, you know, more than just have formal services there. So his first consideration is that, you know, that's not, it's not right to have this in a shul. But on halachic grounds, this is davar harashut. There's no halachic imperative for it. So you can't do it in a shul. He goes on to say, v'ha ceremony shall bat mitzvah, he v'adai divrei rashut v'hevel ba'alma. So this is quite loaded language. He starts off by saying it's divrei rashut, meaning there's no religious obligation in it all. It's an optional service. And then he says it's hevel ba'alma. Hevel ba'alma means it's just a waste of time. It's nothingness. But ancient makom lahatil asot zeh b'beit ha'kneset. There's no grounds to allow it to be done in shul. He's talking about in the shul proper. You know, I don't think he's talking about, I mean, I don't think he's happy about doing it in the social hall. He's talking about having a ceremony in the shul. But Kol Shekein, he says, I can tell you another reason why it's asur. Of a conservator. He says it's all based on reform and conservative Judaism. It doesn't appear anywhere in Shulchan Aruch to have a bat mitzvah. Yeah, it's a reform notion. We don't want anything to do with that. Rakim simcha rashai. Again, very interesting language here. If the father wants to do something at home, he hasn't even mentioned the mother here. Thought maybe it would say if the parents want to do something at home. If the father wants to do something at home, then he can. It's not a davar mitzvah in any sense. You can't regard it as being a sudat mitzvah. It's just a birthday party. Then he goes on to say, you know, if I had the ability, I get rid of bar mitzvahs as well. I don't think I'm just anti-bat mitzvah. I'm equal opportunities here. Get rid of bat mitzvahs and get rid of bar mitzvahs. Bar mitzvahs never made anybody more religiously observant. Bar mitzvah, not even the bar mitzvah boy himself. Not even for 1 minute. Vadraba, on the contrary, many places, you know, you end up with everybody driving their cars to shul. It's terrible. I'll call Panim Mashakvah Hunhag before, the Gam Bazem Makor Mitzvah Kashelevato. So, yeah, you know, this happens already. Can't stop it. But to innovate this for girls where there's no notion of it, halakhic notion of it whatsoever, it's better not to do anything even at home. It's not osa, but you know, better not to do it at all. Certainly, to do it in shul is definitely osa. Do it at home, better you shouldn't, but if you feel you have to, then you can. So this is a fascinating tshuva on many grounds. Some people might accuse me of apikorsut for this, but I would say cautiously that, you know, I wonder if Rav Moshe Feinstein would have written the same thing today. Would he have been so dismissive of bat mitzvah today as he was 50 odd years ago? I say that because, you know, it's clear that he saw no benefit from it whatsoever. He saw it as a negative phenomena, came from a reform background, didn't achieve anything. And, you know, so it's just like a birthday party. It's nothing more than that. You know, I think today's bat mitzvah ceremonies can be much more meaningful. And I think for many, many girls, it does actually give them a very meaningful engagement with Jewish life and Jewish adulthood. Might depend on the community in which you come from and, you know, who he's dealing with. You know, if he's asking, you know, should the Gateshead Yeshiva, you know, introduce bat mitzvah ceremonies for, you know, daughters fathers are in the kollel, then, you know, I'm not sure that it's necessarily so necessary. Those girls are hopefully going to have, in any event, a lifelong commitment to Orthodox Judaism. In a less cloistered community, it's a different dynamic. And there's, I think, a lot to be gained. I also maintain that from the evidence that I've seen in my career is that it's not always true that bar mitzvah doesn't achieve anything for the boys. And certainly it's not true to say it doesn't achieve anything even for the bar mitzvah boy, even for one moment. I think in my experience, that's patently not true. There are many bar mitzvah boys and many bar mitzvah families who engage meaningfully over the course of preparation for the bar mitzvah and, you know, et cetera. So many of those families might well disengage afterwards and fall off the radar. But I think they've had a meaningful experience for a period of time, which can often be picked up on in the future. And I know, I don't regard myself as necessarily a very innovative rabbi in these regards, but, you know, many of my colleagues who are, you know, excellent at outreach work, you know, have, you know, developed their bar mitzvah programs into very meaningful programs, which do serve a valuable kirov purpose. So this is the first shuv of Rav Moshe Feinstein, where really better not to have a bat mitzvah at all. If we look in a second shuva, dated 1959, he's a little bit more flexible on the matter. Says, you know what, if you need to make a kiddush in shul, you can make a kiddush in shul. People make kiddushim for all sorts of things. In our shul, somebody once made a kiddush because I think Watford had been promoted or not demoted or something like that, or they'd won a game. That's unlikely. But they've done something, you know, because they're a football team. You know, it was an excuse to make a kiddush, excuse to, as the person said to me, and it was an excuse to support the shul. So people make kiddushin for all sorts of things. So let them make a kiddush for a bat mitzvah as well. And he also says that, you know, if the girl wants to say to some sort of Dvar Torah in that context, then that's, you know, we'd be better not. You know, certainly shouldn't be done in shul, but it can be done at the kiddush. We better not. But again, if it's going, you know, the rabbi had allowed it or it had got through somehow in the shul diary and the rabbi hadn't managed to nip it in the bud earlier. So you know what? fine, leave it. You know, you don't need to lose credibility in the community over it. So it's interesting how Rav Moshe Feinstein, number one, had a very negative attitude towards Bat Mitzvah celebration, and how his attitude softened a little bit in a fairly short period of time. I'm surmising that possibly he came round to the view that whilst he regarded it as undesirable, it wasn't necessarily the work of the Satan to try and become Orthodox shuls should become conservative or reform, but it was actually coming from from a place where the goal was to be makariv people to Torah and mitzvot and to inspire girls on their Jewish journey rather than turn them off. And of course, different communities need different things. And if one's part of a community where it's not regarded as being terribly necessary to inspire the girls because they're already inspired, you know, then all well and good. Now, in some communities, they make very little business of a bar mitzvah boy. So because they're all well engaged and having a bar mitzvah isn't anything exceptional. If the girls are equally well engaged, then, you know, then that's great. But Rav Moshe Feinstein isn't the only opinion on the matter. Rav Ovadia Yosef has Shuvot on the subject. He has one here I brought from Shelot Shuvot Yabia Omer Chelek Vav or Chaim Simon Kaf Tet, where he says that in actual fact it's definitely a Sudat Mitzvah to celebrate a Bat Mitzvah, just as there's a notion of a Sudat Mitzvah to celebrate a boy reaching halachic maturity. So why should it be any different for a girl? It's definitely a Sudat Mitzvah. He quotes, not in the passage that I've brought from you, but he quotes from the Sri Deish, we'll see in a moment, very positively about the meaningfulness of a Bat Mitzvah. Again, Rav Ovadia is only talking here about a Chagiga, a Suda, with Divrei Torah and with Shirot V'Tishpachot, you know, singing the type of songs you'd sing at a bar mitzvah celebration. So he certainly feels that it's right to celebrate a bat mitzvah in terms of what we know as a bat mitzvah ceremony, which is something which is constantly changing and evolving, and different communities do different things. I don't think it's ever occurred to him the notion of having such a thing in a shul. So he certainly doesn't matter that. But and from other things he's written in other contexts, I think it's fair to say that Rav Ovadia would not have been happy about a bat mitzvah girl speaking in shul, whether it's at the end of the service or in the middle of the service, etc. But certainly the concept of celebrating a bat mitzvah, which Rav Moshe Feinstein has rejected, he relates to Rav Moshe Feinstein and says, I disagree totally with that. If we look at a shuva of the Sri Deish. The Sri Deish was Reb Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg, who was the last, the final rector of the rabbinical seminary in Berlin before the Shoah. And then he relocated to Montreux in Switzerland after the Shoah. He was regarded as one of the, you know, Gedolim left over from pre-war Europe, but he was a German Gadol. That's different to the Lithuanian Gedolim or the Russian Gedolim. He was Western Europe. He had a doctorate. He had a, you know, different perspective on life. He also talks about, he says, certainly those who suggested that it's that it's chukat agoy, it does definitely isn't. Bat mitzvah is something which is done outside of the shul. It's not chukat agoy. Its purpose is to engage young Jewish women in Jewish life, and therefore he thinks it's a value. He thinks it's permitted and it's a value. Again, he's not permitting a shul ceremony, but the celebration for Bat Mitzvah, he is permitting. And he makes the interesting observation that there are those who are against and there are those who are for. And everybody is being mechaving to the same thing. Everybody is being mechaving here l'shem shamayim. You know, the question is, what is the best way to promote and maintain Orthodox Judaism? Is it by having certain innovations, or is it by resisting all innovations? But we've all got the same end goal in mind. So I think this is a very instructive teshuva as well. Just to finish off with the observation, of course, that it's a very interesting phenomena that, you know, these three gedolim didn't countenance the notion of a bat mitzvah inside the shul at the end of a Shabbat morning service, tacked onto a Shabbat morning service. So, you know, not part of the Seder HaTfilah, but, you know, associated with the Shabbat service. You know, that's something that had never been, they never considered. Nowadays, again, it's, you know, most modern Orthodox communities who, you know, regard Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Avadi Yosef and Rav Sri Deish as being important, significant, defining poskim. Nevertheless, you know, we do, many of the our communities do allow such things in one format or another. And, you know, it's interesting to try and work out why that shift has taken place and how we relate to, you know, to the Gdolim who said that it wasn't permissible, why we feel that the situation is different, et cetera, et cetera. That's perhaps a discussion for another time. So ad kan for this evening's discussion on bar and bat mitzvah.